Do I, am I using this one? No, this one? Okay. Okay. if you'll take your seats, please. I want to welcome you to Beale House Arts. And this is our second event for this show. The show is called Journey to the Underworld and Other Forbidden Places Before the End of Time. I love that title, and Jane will be talking about that and how that that concept develops in this show. Before we begin, I'd like to thank TPR for being here. They're taping us today, and this will be on their archives on their website, so you can tell your friends what they missed and then let them hear it by going to TPR. That should be up, I'm not sure when, but in the next few weeks. We'll send an email out when that's available. I'd like to thank all of you for being here. We have a few new faces in the crowd and some wonderful dear old friends. No emphasis on the old. I want to thank all of you for coming today. And I just want to tell you a little bit about Beale House before we begin. For those of you who don't know about Beale House, our motto is creating community through the arts, and we do that with virtually every exhibition, 8 or 9 a year, that we do, and with our events like this, where we bring community people together to talk about issues and art making and themes that are current in contemporary art in San Antonio. We are also a classroom. During the week, we put all the tables and chairs out, and we offer the Go Arts program for the residents on the property. This semester, the new semester starts next week, we are opening up the Go Arts program to community members as well. Classes are offered free of charge, and all materials are provided. Our teachers are amazing. They all have MA and MFA degrees, and they're all very exceptional teachers. So if you're interested in taking classes with us, please see me after the discussion today. This event today is the second event for this show. We usually do 2 or 3 per show. Today we have the artist Jane Madrigal speaking, and she's invited Laura Rios, who was born into the Matachin Danza family that does Matachin Danza, and she'll be talking about Aztec culture, Chichimeca culture, and how that expresses itself today. This is a theme that we have been covering at Beale House since November, when we began with the discussion by John Philip Santos on the Cuatichan Mapa. That discussion, too, will also eventually be available on the TPR archives. So I would like to introduce Jane Madrigal, our amazing artist. Jane has also been a visiting artist at Beale House. We've initiated a couple of years ago a visiting artist program. The artist comes in and teaches for a semester. Jane's been teaching painting and printmaking to our Goldens here on the property. Some of their work is visible in the gallery, for that effort and for all of that work, she receives a show at the end of that program. She's continuing to teach with us. She won't be here at Beale House. She'll be at another location. But here at Beale House, this is our visiting art program. We've done this about 3 times now. There hasn't been a lot of word about it, but we are hoping to spread the word that we do offer that option, that opportunity for San Antonio artists. We're very excited about being able to do that. So I would like to introduce Jane. Thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming out and supporting my work, and for all the support that I do get in this community. I like to start off by acknowledging all the ancestors and the people who have paved the way for me to be here today, the people who have passed on. And also the people who are in my life right now who continue to be an inspiration for the type of work I do. I think I would like to start off by giving you a little historical background about myself, because it's important, because my life and my art are totally intermeshed one with another. There's no separation between the two. didn't go to art school. I'm completely self-taught. I do hold a bachelor's degree in public relations and a master's degree in education, but I've never taken an art class, ironically enough. This journey to this underworld and my personal journey started, I guess, but when I was 7 years old with the death of my sister, who was six. It was a very traumatic time in my life, obviously, to have literally witnessed her passing. But it was, in retrospect, reflecting back now on how things have progressed in my life. And I'm also 42 years old. I want to go ahead and state that now because some people think I'm 25. But I'm not. I'm 42. So I've got a little bit of experience behind me and a little bit of taking a couple of hard knocks and being able to pull myself up and get back into the swing of things. But reflecting back on my life, I think that was probably the time when I first realized and started connecting with the dead and understanding that we do have a connection to our ancestors and the people who have passed on. At that time, though, you know, I was very young, and we were not brought up to be, I guess, with a lot of culture in my family. I did grow up here in the West Side, but back then it was all about assimilation. My parents were very much into trying to get us assimilated and out of the West Side unscathed. So we weren't taught Spanish or any of that, or any of those things, and weren't really taught any of our traditions back then. It was something that I had to rediscover for myself. And for me, that happened when the very first trip that I took to Mexico with my grandmother. I was 21 at the time. And it's kind of interesting because when I went back to kind of look at how things progressed, I was told by my late mentor, who I'll get into a little bit about the work that we did together, that things change about every 7 years. You can kind of pinpoint like a major shift in your life and things that happen in your life that kind of maybe turn you in a different direction. And so for me at 21, that was it. I dropped out of college, and I guess we could kind of say that kind of helped. Because once I dropped out of college, I moved to Austin, and I began trying to discover who I was. One of the things that, when I was in college in the 80s, that I did discover was that I definitely was not assimilated. I thought I was doing good, but when I got there, I realized I was the only brown person. I was like, wait a minute. And I had never thought about, you know, race and ethnicity prior to that, because, you know, you grow up in the West Side, and everybody's brown, and you don't really, you know, everybody's trying to be assimilated, and you don't question too much about your culture and how it's, and lack of it, you know, growing up at that time. But once I got into college, I realized that I didn't quite fit in. So by the time I got into my junior year, I decided to drop out, and I moved to Austin. And it was in Austin that I really became politicized. Austin was still a small, cool, funky town. It was at the height of the slacker era. I don't know if you all remember that movie, but it was a time when you could have basically a part-time job and spend the rest of your time kind of slacking off in Austin, being in a band or being a performance artist, which I think I was at that time. Things like that. Nothing like now. I don't think you can have a part-time job and you live in Austin. But what happened was I ran into a lot of people who were in the Chicano movement, the Brown Berets. And even though that in itself had a lot of crazy political issues, it was brown people that looked like me trying to reclaim culture, reclaim identity, instill some kind of pride in being who we are. Something that I hadn't really fully experienced until I went to Mexico when I said, wow, this is what it's like to be a Mexican. That kind of started to unfold many things for me. One of them was the whole concept of being Catholic and Jesus and God and the Virgin Mary and the saints, and those roles suddenly started playing a different, started coming up for me and playing a different, I started seeing them in a different light, I guess you could say. And understanding that in these churches, the Virgin Mary or the Virgen de Guadalupe was the prominent figure, not necessarily God on the cross or Jesus on the cross, which when I was growing up, that was the main image you saw in church. So, and which was, you know, at that point, the way we connected with spirit, right? And so once I had that, once I went to Mexico, I came home and started to question and started to read up and discover things like, hey, the Virgen de Guadalupe really isn't, you know, necessarily the mother of Jesus. You know, she actually was an Aztec deity that was revered for centuries, Mother Earth, by the indigenous people. And it was like, okay, well, what are indigenous people? I thought Indians were all dead. You know, at least that's what I was taught in school. You know, and then during that time, also, we had the Zapatista uprising. So suddenly there were like these Mayan Indians that, you know, manifested out of the hills in Chiapas and came down and started a revolution. And so all these things were kind of blowing my mind at the time. And, but all these things started to inspire me to paint. And what I painted was images and icons of these deities that I felt somewhat connected to, curious about, and wanted to kind of learn more of. And so some of the very first art pieces that I created at the time, one of them is sitting right here. It is a kitchen island with Quetzalcoatl on it, who is a feathered serpent, a manifestation of Venus, which is a very significant planet in the cosmos that the Aztec calendar and the cycles are based upon. And I believe like all our this whole coming, ending of the fifth sun and coming of the sixth sun is also based on the cycle of Venus, but on a larger cosmic scale. Another piece that was very I created very early on was this table. I started painting furniture. I never considered myself an artist until I was, I don't know, in my 30s, I think, when I started painting on canvas. I'm like, oh, now I'm an artist. Before, I was just painting tables and chairs and furniture, and I called myself a painter. But never an artist, because I didn't go to art school. I figured you needed an art degree to have that title. But after I started painting murals, when I moved back to San Antonio in 2000, and I started working for Sonanto Cultural Arts, had a couple kids, painted some murals, and it was during that time that I was able to go ahead and embrace that title as artist. And so I officially became an artist in my eyes, although I had been creating art for quite some time. But anyways, back in those early years, in those years while I was in Austin, had a lot of significance in how I evolved as a person, as a human being, as a spiritual being, because I was exposed to different people who were part of the Chicano movement. Other activists through my art. I met a woman. What happened was I got this crazy internship. I don't know how I got this internship, but I got an internship to teach art to kids in the Valley. They didn't tell me they were going to be alternative school kids or any of that stuff. I just knew I was going to the Valley to teach art to high school kids getting their high school diploma. When I got there, it was the height of the gang movement. It was like 94, I believe, right? I'm in this like crazy, these alternative schools, and it's super rough and super kind of out of control. But all these gangbangers were calling themselves Crips and Bloods, and I was like really upset about that. I'm like, you can't be a Crip or a Blood. That's, you know, this is real Grand City, you know? Like, come up with a better name, guys, you know, like for real, and some better colors, you know? It's like, but what happened during that time was I was exposed to graffiti artist, and, you know, and gang members, and that whole, like, graffiti is art, graffiti is tagging, yada, yada, yada. So we're not going to have that discussion, but that's what kind of started my work with activism, because I winded up bringing some of the kids that I felt were really, really good graffiti artists to Austin for an exhibit at Mexiarte. It was a part of their Young Latino artist exhibition. I think now it just goes by YLA or something. I was like, why do you all change? You know, it's like the Young Latino Artist Exhibition, I think, sounds a lot better than YLA. The YLA exhibit. And they still have that exhibit going on. So I brought these kids down. And we had an exhibit. And from there, I organized a larger exhibit incorporating the kids from the Valley and the kids in Austin who were also creating graffiti at the time, although it was none of it had been shown in galleries. I had put together an exhibit, and it was really super successful. And I started getting grants from the city to continue to work with these youth and organize them in that way. But this person showed up to my exhibit and was very impressed with what she saw. And her name was Marcia Gomez. She was the executive director of the Alma de Mujer and a founding member of what is, I believe there's still in existence, the Indigenous Women's Network. She had a center out near Lake Travis, out west Austin. Now it's a super high-end neighborhood. But back then, it was out in the boonies. What she would do was work with medicine plants. And she would bring in Native women from Canada, from the U.S., and from Mexico to come together to study with traditional elders and learn how to kind of reclaim those traditions. Now, remember, I didn't have these traditions growing up. It was something that I was taught in my 20s during that time. While I was working with her in the gardens, understanding how medicine works, understanding how spirit works, understanding how the philosophy and concepts of Gunandismo work, I discovered that, in fact, my great-grandmother was a curandera. My grandmother practiced it, and she's still kind of, it was at that time where people were trying to be assimilated, and nobody wanted an herbal tea or a limpia. They wanted to go to, like, the real doctor and get, like, pills or something, right? And now it's kind of ironic because here we are, you know, and my kids, they don't go to the doctor. They get the herbs and the limpias. And, you know, they don't necessarily complain about it either because they've learned, they know that it works and it's a part of who we are. So all these things come together for me, and I'm able to express and explore through my paintings. I had a real issue with patriarch. I don't know. I still kind of have an issue with it. But growing up, I was told, yeah, as a small child, that I was cursed, you know? And kind of like having that instilled in me that, you know, women are cursed because, you know, we have a menstrual cycle and, you know, men will tell us what to do. I was born in the 70s, so it was still that kind of mentality. The women's movement had just started and I had just been born, so it was not, it was still very much, you know, you're just going to get married when you grow up, and that was all that was expected of me. So I guess it was when I was started painting murals but aside from the graffiti artists, because for me that was about trying to save the youth and trying to give them an outlet to be creative. And trying to educate people that, you know, these kids are not bad. We shouldn't incarcerate them. They just need some structure. They need some support. They need somebody to guide them until they're of that age where they're able to kind of do it on their own. And between 15 and 25, I think, for men, is where they're real vulnerable to getting caught up in whatever, the street life, the tagging life, the, you know, if they don't have jobs, you know, things that they might get involved in that might not be too great. But usually by about the time they're 25, if we can keep them out of jail, they usually get it. They usually get a real job at some point. They usually grow up. And so that was what that was about. But when I moved to San Antonio and I started working with San Anto, and started actually painting murals and kind of understanding how you can use art to educate on in his, you know, his people about history, it kind of changed for me. And so I was having issues, I guess, mostly with my self-esteem, as many people, I think, have issues with self-esteem as to who am I to paint, you know, these awesome, badass people? Like, it should be somebody like Deborah or somebody more awesome than me, you know? But I had to learn to get over it and realize that that is the role of, you know, a community artist. That is the role of, or it should be the role of a muralist, to be able to tell the stories of their people. And I am just as capable as anybody else to tell those stories. I shouldn't be, you know, thinking that I just because I don't have an art degree or just because, you know, I don't know, I have, you know, I don't think of myself as being somebody who is worthy of painting greatness, that was not something that I needed to get over it. And so it took me a while, but I'm kind of got over it because it's like it's your responsibility. And so what happened, I think, where there was a big turning point was when I had a dream. And for those of you who may or may not be aware of ancestor worship, I'm told that the ancestors talk to you in two different ways. One is through possession, and the other way is through your dreams. So it's really important to pay attention to those dreams, because that's the way your people talk to you. And so in this dream, it had been about... Well, my mentor, Marcia, was killed violently one day by her schizophrenic son. So that kind of threw things off for me, and I winded up moving back to San Antonio. I guess that's why I didn't continue on this path of healing with the curanderas and, you know, traveling back and forth to Oaxaca. It was on my way back from Oaxaca, where I was studying with a woman by the name of Doña Enriqueta Contreras, that we found out that she had been murdered. And then 2 months later, I found I was pregnant. And then I decided, okay, this is too much for me. Let me just go back home where I can kind of regroup. And I kind of got off that red road, hadn't, you know, worked with medicine or thought about a sweat lodge or any of those things. Focused on having children, focused on painting murals. But it was one day I had this crazy dream, and Marcia busted out of the earth, like, and she was like pissed. She was like, "You, I taught you so much and you're not doing anything with it. You're just, you know," she was not happy with me at all. And so that was when I was like, okay, I guess I should rethink and remember and try to heal myself from that susto that I got from her death and push forward. And start the process of not only healing myself, but taking those baby steps to helping heal the community. Because I did learn a lot of really powerful things back in those times. Things that I see manifesting in the world today. And one of them is, you know, this whole concept of, you know, the sixth sun that we are now in. One of the things I was told back then was that women would be the salvation of the world, that this time, this patriarchal world would come to an end. This fifth sun, this way of living and being that isn't sustainable, would eventually cease to exist, and it would be the women that would have to lead the movement or lead that shift, lead that change. And it would be a change of consciousness, not a armed revolution or any of those things, because I'm like, let's kill a bunch of people. There, you know, let's arm ourselves and go crazy, right? But no, that's not it. This was back then, you know, when my really hardcore rebel days. I'm pretty chilled out now. But in, you know, when you're 20s, you know, you want to go kick somebody's butt. But now, you know, I know that violence does not solve anything. With the shift that we've seen, that we felt, that has occurred, you can see how the women are starting to rise. We have, I think we've elected, in you know, with our elections, it's like we've got the most women elected with this past presidential election. with the stuff that's going on in Canada, the Idle No More movement. But in the same token, you also see, you know, issues where little girls are getting shot in the head for wanting to be educated. Women are being, you know, brutally raped. And I think that those are things that have kind of always been there because it's patriarchy, and that's kind of how it manifests in its way of oppressing women. But with technology, we're all aware of it now. It's not something that might have happened. And if you weren't on that bus, you know, you wouldn't know or hear about it. But now with technology and the internet and the news, we all know things as they happen. And it's important for us to understand that the time is now. This is the time that we've been waiting for. And we are the ones that we've been waiting for. During my time at ALMA, sometimes I'd read, you know, come across articles written by super awesome people. And, you know, you read a word, you read a sentence that just has so much influence and power on the way you think and the way you see the world. And one of them for me was an article that was put out by the National Council of Churches. I believe that's what it's called. And the name of the magazine was "We Are the Ones We Are Waiting For, Women of Color Organizing for Transformation." Now, this was an article written in the mid-90s. But it blew my mind because I was always, growing up to like, oh, there's a second coming and God's going to come and we're all going to be judged and you're going to burn in hell forever or you're going to go to heaven and live happily ever after. And that was pretty much it in terms of, you know, what I was told was going to happen. But when I read that, I realized that it's like, hey, you know, that makes more sense than some guy in the sky coming down to judge us and make us all feel bad if we didn't, you know, abide by his Ten Commandments or whatever. And so that's one of the things that I've always taken to heart when I do my work, whether it be working with the spirits, working with medicine, working in the schools, doing different programming with the children, but knowing that we are part of that divine energy that comes from the most sacred and most profound place in the universe, that we are God and we create our own reality and we have the power to change. We can't change the world, but we can change ourselves. That was another big thing that I read. I was like, oh my God, I've been trying to change the world and I can't change the world. This is like banging your head against the wall. You know, you can only change yourself. And when you change yourself, you know, slowly but surely the world will begin to change around you. But yeah, so those are some very powerful lessons that I learned early on and that I've tried to carry with me and pass on to the generations that come on, that I've been able to influence in terms of young women, my own children, even elders. Sometimes elders don't want to hear it, and sometimes they're stuck, and I understand, you know, like my dad. You know, he's never going to be like matriarchal loving or any of that stuff. He's just going to be a grumpy old man. But he's old and his time will come. You know, like the old, you know, it's just a mentality, a mindset. It's like my grandmother when I try to educate her about a Tonantzin because she's a Guadalupana and she's very much into the Virgen de Guadalupe, but she was not having Tonantzin. That was not like, she was like, mm-mm, no, ma'am. You know, and yeah, she was not down with that story at all. But, you know, she's 80 years old, so I guess she can be okay with that. So that's a little insight on where I've been and kind of where I'm coming from. A lot of the images that I do paint are images of powerful women. I had figured back in my, you know, when I started realizing the power I had when I, you know, in creating art and that people were actually liking what I created, that I would try to pretty much stick with painting women because men, you know, they have a lot of play in the world and people have talked about them and I don't hear a lot about women. And so that feminine principle is a big theme in my life. With the images that you see here, I think my son is pretty much the only man that I've been able to paint. With the murals, oh, David, no, but I didn't paint you. I carved you in wood. It's a different thing. It's a different thing. But I know, right? But yeah, so painting women so that we can remember who they are, so that we can try to educate ourselves in history and to know that we as women do have a very powerful and significant role in history, and have always had a powerful and significant role in history. It's just not told because we're not the ones that get to write the history books. And essentially, that's it. What I was taught was that in the beginning of ceremonial time, that men and women walk side by side, each having a divine and significant role. But it was colonization, inquisition, you know, greed, exploitation that changed those roles and created an imbalance between masculine and feminine energy. And that imbalance is what has manifested in the world as, you know, patriarchal values that have destroyed matriarchal societies, destroyed matriarchal cultures, destroyed the Mother Earth and ourselves and our health and our well-being. But that there would be that shift, and that shift has happened. And it's now our responsibility as women. And I was told it's a seventh generation thing. Remember I told you earlier things happen in cycles of seven? I think every 7 years you get a whole new brand new set of sales, and you know things are always changing and moving. But and I know that when we were working with the medicine, they told us that it takes seven generations to break down disease. So say, for instance, with diabetes, it would take, if we stopped everything that causes diabetes now, it would still take seven generations before all that was completely eradicated from the system, from our health system. And so women of the seventh generation, which is this generation now, and the youth that are coming up, it's their responsibility and it's their roles as guardians and protectors of the Mother Earth to lead the shift, to lead that movement, to reclaim those matriarchal values, to understand that we need to have a relationship with Mother Earth if we are going to live and be sustainable. I know back in the day when we would talk about this time now, because it's like the end of the fifth sun, you know, and the beginning of the sixth sun and all this, you know, cataclysmic events, and it was like, how are we going to survive? What do we need to know to survive? And I was told we just need to know two things: how to grow our own food and how to cooperate with our neighbors. And we were like, that's it? We don't even know anything else, you know? But you know, now in retrospect, those are going to be your survival skills. If you can grow your own food, because we all know at this point that society and corporations, Monsanto, whoever, the stuff that we buy at the grocery stores is not going to be healthy for us. If you can't say it, my mom says, if you can't say it, don't eat it. When you look at the label and it's got all this like weird 10,000 syllable words, she's just like, just don't eat it. It's not good for you. And then cooperating with your neighbors, because those are the people that, I mean, how many people know their neighbors? It's something that I think we've kind of gotten away from because of technology. You know, we go home and we watch TV. We go home and get on the computer. But we don't have those relationships with the people that just live a couple of feet from us every day. And so it's important for us to be able to connect on those very humanistic levels so that we can heal the earth, heal ourselves, and heal our families, and be healthy for the next several generations to come. So change starts with yourself. You can't change the world, you can only change yourself. So I'm hoping that you are inspired by the work that I produce. I hope you're inspired by the words that I have shared with you today. I hope you go home and think about it and reflect on that. I started making medicine again. I hadn't made medicine in a long time. I hadn't even planted a garden. And this past year, I winded up planting a garden. And lo and behold, I was like, oh, look, my thumbs are still green after all these years. Who knows? Who would have thought? But I was very successful at planting. You know, my garden thrived. So I was able to get the good corn, grow the good corn, grow the good chiles. I was growing amaranth, all those traditional foods that we should try to start incorporating back into our system so that we can heal ourselves. I did bring some for you all to, because I know everybody has a flu. I brought some cough syrups and some tinctures and some salves if you all want to take a look at them. I winded up reconnecting with one of the women who was a part of those original 21 women that were studying at ALMA with Doña Enriqueta back in the 90s through Facebook. Good old Facebook brings us together when we hadn't seen each other in 10 years, and we had come to visit, and we sat, and we made medicine together. And from there, we've just continued. It's been 2 years now since I started making medicine, and like I said, I've started growing my own plants now. So I'm hoping that for the future, I'll be able to kind of shift my focus into working more with that, because setting up scaffolding and all that craziness with the murals gets kind of tiring and old when you're getting up there in age. When I was young, I could do it. But nowadays, it's a little rough. I also want to share with you, what time is it? I don't want to go too far. I want to kind of keep track of, okay, we're good. I want to share with you real briefly before I turn it over to Laura, and she's going to share with you some of the stories of these women that you do see here, and then we can talk about, you know, in the Q&A or whatever, some of the images that you do see hanging on the wall. But I want to share with you a couple of projects that I'm working on right now, my current projects, and one of them is a mural I'm about to start with the Martina Street Women's Center. We're going to be painting a mural that addresses the historical violence against women. So I'll be working with three middle schools in the east side. The mural will be painted on parachute cloth, and we're going to, I think they're going to go on display at UTSA for Women's History Month. And then it'll be installed on the West Falls Bridge. So I don't know if you guys have ever been out to the Martina Street Women's Center, but that's that bridge that is right there. April, I think, is the time we'll have the unveiling and the blessing. But they'll be on display at UTSA for Women's History Month. So you take a look out for that. Another project that I'm working on is a series of woodcuts of revolutionary women. A professor friend of mine, was interested in seeing a project like that happen, and he asked me if I would head that up, and I was like, sounds great, but I don't know how to do woodcuts. So I wrote a grant to the city, and I got to go to Arizona and study with a master printer. And so I do have a couple of those woodcuts here on display, but the whole series will be going on display in Madison, Wisconsin. The opening is March the 12th. For International Women's Day, or for Women's History Month, which will be in, a month and a half, 2 months. So those are my two up-and-coming projects. I guess that's pretty much it.
Jane, could you just briefly talk about the installation before Laura gets to the individual works?
Sure. This part of the installation here that we're sitting, is because everything I do has to be guided by the spirits, because that's my karma. This part of the installation was created in reverence of the gods, the deities, the archetypes of the Aztec cosmos. So we've got Gayoshalki, who is the moon goddess. Mayawel, who is and I like to paint women who have like super crazy mythology where they're like super tough or beating up on people or leading wars or what have you. We have Gayoshalki, who is a goddess of the Maguey plant. Over here we've got Tatsultiotl, who is a eater of filth. She's the one you would go to, and she would purge you of all your sins prior to death. But she was also the patron saint of prostitutes and I believe women who are giving birth as well. This image here is an image of an Aztec princess by the name of Three Flint Knife, and it's her ceremonial wedding bath. I thought it was kind of cool when I was reading up, and in the Aztec culture or back in those days, if you got married, you took a bath together. I was like, that's kind of interesting. Maybe I had to get married, you know, because I have no desire to get married. But maybe if I had a really cool bath with some anointing oils and some people pouring some, you know, sparkling water on me, it might be more appealing. So that is Princess Three Flint Knife. And then here is a series of images created. And her name is Princess Six Monkey. And she was the last Mestec warrior princess. And so in the glyphs, and this is a whole story. I wish I could have done her whole story, but it wasn't possible. But this is this glyph shows that she was born of, her parents were born of flesh and bone. And the story is that she was the third in line of the throne, and her two older brothers had been killed in battle. So she was up for the throne, and she was advised to go ahead and take that offer. And in the process, there were two guys from a neighboring town, I guess, that had insulted her. And so she went ahead and took care of her own business, which I thought was kind of interesting. She didn't send out somebody to go, you know, capture these guys and sacrifice them or whatever went down back then. But she went ahead and did it herself. So that image above the fireplace is the image of Princess Six Monkey taking the two men that had insulted her captive. And then she meets this guy named Eleven Wind, and they get married, and that is a picture of their ceremonial bath. So it was like Princess Six Monkey was born, she kicked some butt, and then she got married and lived happily ever after. So that was kind of like, well, that's kind of an interesting princess story, not necessarily the princess story you usually get. Usually they're locked in a tower, and some guy has to rescue them, and then they get married and they live happily ever after. But not her. You know what I mean? She was born, she kicked butt, she met a guy, they got married, they lived happily ever after. It's like, okay, cool. The image behind you is a corn goddess, and I painted her for my daughter's Chilonan ceremony, and but I put my daughter's face in it, so that's my daughter, actually. But when I looked at the image online as to what it looked like, the sculpture, it was very Afro, the features were very Afrocentric. So obviously, you know, yeah, they were very Afrocentric, and I thought it actually looked like my daughter. So her face fit very well, because my kids are half black. And so her face fit really well in that image. And how do you say her? Chakmel? Is that how you say her name? The corn goddess? Senteot, that's it, Senteot. That's who she is. Behind we have Guatlique, who is the earth mama, the serpent one. Now, she's super intense, and I think it was at the talk that we had with John Philip Santos that had said that she had been unearthed, and she was so hideous that they buried her again. And then, you know, so she had been unearthed and reburied, I think, like, what, twice before she was finally brought out and kind of kept up. And she was super intense when I was painting her. I was like, oh, my God, you are a snaky woman. So I tried to make her as beautiful as I could, because she is, I could see how people would be afraid of her. And so that is her image there. The image on the upper right-hand corner I guess it's kind of a reflection of myself with the hummingbird. I had found out many years ago that my ancestors on my dad's side of the family, his father's people were Yaqui. So the Yaquis believed that women had dreaming power. And that was a theme that had kind of come up in the past. Remember I told you about dreams? And that the hummingbird was a symbol of the dreams. And so that piece there is my dreaming woman, because I do have prophetic dreams. This is a image in the back in the other section, which is the section I've dedicated to the muertos. So we've got like what would be your higher deities in this room, and then you have your dead ancestors in the other room. And in this dream I literally had to battle the devil, but I was Saint Michael, so it was okay, and I was successful. but it was intense. And so when I woke up, it was like, I don't know, like a couple of weeks before the end of the year. And it was like this urgency to paint this image before the end of the year. So, and it was one of those times when I was a single mom and I had my kids, and it was like the dad was going to take them from New Year's, and everybody was like, woohoo, you get a New Year's to yourself. Let's go party. And I'm like, I got to paint this image before the stroke of midnight. Sorry, guys. And they were like, are you serious? You're not going to go out? I'm like, no, I got to paint. So that image was also an image from this dream. And when you go into this room here that's dedicated to the muertos, on this wall here is an image of myself and Marcia. And that image I painted after I had that dream where she busted out of the earth and was yelling at me for not being, for, it's going to be in this red room here. Yeah, on this side here. The other two images, the woman in blue is Roberta Blackgoat. And she was a mentor to Marcia. She was a Navajo elder. And then on the top is a tribute I did for Raul Salinas after he passed away. And then at the bottom is a woman by the name of Janet McLeod, and also one of the founders of the, probably the founding mother of the Indigenous Women's Network. But she did other things. She founded Women of All Red Nations and was a part of the fishing rights struggles in Washington. And she was also a mentor to my mentor. So there was a time when I was trying to understand her a little better. And in that, I remember, you know, and fortunately, I was able to meet both of these women and have a little bit of a relationship with them. More Janet McLeod than Roberta Blackgoat, because Janet came through Alma a lot more often than Roberta Blackgoat. But still, she was still a very, very powerful woman. And I got to listen to her pray in her traditional tongue. And it was just one of those times when you're like, you know, you're sitting with some very powerful women. The image on this end here, the two images, the one on the top, I do a summer program sometimes that the city sponsors where I'll get young graffiti artists again, and we have to do real art, not graffiti, in order for them to receive credit for community service. And so I brought in a couple of artists, and this particular project was done with an artist by the name of Bernice Williams. And it was it's called ensemblage, not collage, ensemblage. And it's because it's got different, it's just not paper, a collage of paper. And so that was kind of a tribute for my son. Like I said, my kids are half black, and so I think it's real important for black people and brown people to kind of come together and find a, you know, our struggles are similar, and if we were to join forces, I mean, come on now. We'd be able to make great strides in trying to get our communities back on track. So that is, that piece was from that class. And the top says Raza Cosmica, and then on the bottom, or right underneath it, it says, today is my opportunity that I have. Today's my opportunity that my ancestors didn't have. And it was this crazy poster with a census poster, I guess, because they were going to start putting Native American, and you had different choices under Native American for the census. It was a big, they were really trying to educate people on, like, their indigenous roots and ancestors, or I don't know. It was a census poster, but it had all these really cool images of different Apaches. And so that was their little poster to promote the census. And then it just says, you know, black and brown warriors unite in dignity and power. And so I've got Geronimo, and then I've got, I think the guys from the Olympics that put up the black power fist and had gotten their Olympic medals taken. So, let me see. And on the other walls, we've got my tribute to David Zamora Casas. Yay! As you walk in woodcut, somebody had sent him a picture of himself really young in front of his anti-oppression church of hardcore folk art. And I'm like, if that's not a historic image, I don't know what is. I'm like, I'm going to cut this in wood. And so I've got that image along with a woodcut that I've done of my daughter on that side. All right, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Laura because I know we're kind of running over time. Well, we're good, but I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So, and then we'll have some Q&A if you all want later.